Space Oddity.
Welcome back to Space Oddity, the podcast of the CRC 1265 Refiguration of Spaces. Today we are sitting here with Christina Quarte and Paula Medina Garcia. I'm very happy that you're here. And we will more broadly talk about borders and the intersecting topics of migration, colonial histories, and maybe a little bit about climate change as well.
I'm Daniel, and happy that you found time to talk to us.
It would be nice if you could shortly introduce yourselves, and then we just jump straight in. Paula.
Okay, do you want to? First of all, thank you for having me here. I can say that I have a PhD in political and administration science and international relations with emphasis in political geography. I defended my dissertation, Power, Space and Mobility, Trajectories of Afro-descendant Women from the Colombian Pacific Region last year at University of Madrid. And after that, I obtained a 3-year postdoctoral contract that has made possible for me to be here at the SVB as a visiting researcher. My postdoctoral project is still a work in progress, but it mainly focuses on the multi-scalar bordering othering processes taking place in Spanish geographies. The project tries to unveil the material and symbolic character of the border, emphasizing on how borders' spatialities are produced and contested in the interplay of migration regimes and migrants' agency.
Christina. So, I am Christina Kort. I'm also very happy to be here with all of you. And I studied sociology and politics as well. I mostly worked on migration, integration, racism. I'm also very interested in climate change and environmental politics, actually. And for the last 4 years, I worked on my PhD on borders and more specifically on fortified borders, that is, borders that are very much controlled with the fences or other barriers. And I worked on how migration is controlled at these borders. And for that, I worked on 4 case studies on 4 borders in 8 countries, actually. I did interviews in all those countries, and it's the borders between Morocco and Algeria, then Pakistan and India, Hungary and Serbia, and finally US and Mexico. I also just finished my PhD, so I worked on the topic of borders for the last years, and now I will move on with the migration and climate change as well.
Amazing. Well, first of all, congratulations on your PhDs. I know it's probably a long way, but at the end, very gratifying to have it. And we thought to just start, you know, really broadly with the topic of borders. I think it's something that, you know, everyone kind of knows what it is. Everyone has been crossing borders, most of us, but what functions do they have, actually? Borders mean exclusion of people. So they're trying to keep something out or some people out, but they also can serve for containment. So, you know, keeping people, goods, things inside the nation. So borders serve different purposes, defending military attacks, for controlling national territories, preventing smuggling, illegal transports, but they are also super important for national identity, for the definition of a political body. We thought to start with the fact that in the last decades, borders have become smartified, and even more borders have become more fortified. Maybe we start with this question, like, can we shed light on how these new systems of modern, diverse, and smart borders work? What functions do they have nowadays?
Yeah, I can start on a very general level, because I think indeed borders have very different functions, and although these functions have changed over time, because in history, of course, borders have been very much about defending their own territory against enemies from the outside. They have been about military defense. This is still the case today. There are still borders and also border fortifications made to defend the territory. In wars, for example, but also today they are much more about controlling mobility of people or goods. So they have changed their functions. I think the symbolic function of borders, that is how borders create identity or differentiate the inside from the outside, the national identity of the people living in the territory, this is something that has always existed. I think even in very older historical borders, there has also always been this idea of who's the us and who is the other, who's inside and who's outside, to kind of create identity. This is, I think, something that has not really changed over time or is very persistent. And of course, today there are those new trends of smartification of borders. There are new ways to control borders, actually, with more modern technologies, which makes it possible actually to make borders almost invisible if we want to. Sometimes if you cross a border, you don't even see where the border is. You just feel maybe something happening. But if you have the right passport, if you have the right to cross the border, there's border control. But in the way it is smartified, the border almost becomes invisible. And for that, it is very interesting that in the same time, there's this trend of fortifying borders. So making borders very visible and very obvious, and almost like the ideas want to show that there is a border. This is a very different way to control borders. So there are those both trends of smartifying borders and fortifying borders. And I think it's very interesting to see how they happen at the same time.
I do agree that borders mean exclusion and containment, but I will add to that depiction of the border a dimension of inclusion, transition and movement, as borders have met different functions depending on how they are governed, used and experienced by different actors. Indeed, in border studies, we've seen multiple ways to classify them. But to me, to talk about the implications of the border is to talk about the production, dimensions, functions, and effects of this social institution. When talking about production, for example, we can discuss the implication of thinking the border as a natural or physiographic limit or an artificial one. But I'm not going to give too much space to this discussion because critical geographers has already pointed how these boundaries can be defined as the result of social processes of meaning-making. And this meaning of the border has changed over time and space, as Christina said, revealing the actual mutability of the border. About the dimensions of the border, I want to embrace the idea of multidimensionality. Despite the tendency to separate in a dual way the materiality of the border from its discursive and symbolic dimension, we can think both of these dimensions as co-constitutives. What do I mean by this? Not only infrastructures and technologies of the border, such as walls, fences, checkpoints, and biometrics, give materiality to the border. Also, processes of signification and communication of the border are behind the reification and internalization in terms of material effects. Actually, feminist thinkers have already addressed the impact of these material and symbolic constitutive dimensions. For example, in Racialized Boundaries, Florian Ancias and Nira Jubal-Davis explore from an intersectional and anti-racist perspective the ways in which gender, race, and class were articulated in a productive way, both in terms of defining boundaries of the nation states and the constituents of identity. So as by addressing this multidimensional character of the border, I think it's also related with their effects or impacts, as the border is unquestionably productive. What we cannot deny is how borders are at the center of experience, and this experience will be always situated and shaped by other power regimes such as gender, race, class. Borders are not only a foundation of modern nation states and a product of modernity and coloniality, but also a key element in everyday life geographies. If we think about how this institution is produced, or rather reproduced and enforced day to day through a different kind of practices of bordering. I will say that borders meet different functions, and the relevance of each one of them will depend on the scales, temporalities, actors, and practices that we are incorporating to the analysis. For example, in relation to the nation states, borders, territoriality, sovereignty, national identity need to be thought together. And in this particular formation, the border has different interrelated functions. For example, a legal function, because the border marks the limits of the power of states in terms of law enforcement, rights and duties of citizens. A cultural and affective function in terms of identity, belonging, and social ethos. as Christina said, this cultural function separate us from them, and it's really important to the construction of the national identity, for example. Also, the border has an economic function because the border draws the limit of the internal or domestic market, and a more commonly overlooked function, the environmental one, because the border also demarcates the access and right to land, resources, and ecosystem services. Paradoxically, the border is an institution of both continuity and discontinuity. If we turn our attention to migration, for example, the functions of border change depending on the people trying to cross the border. So some people are allowed to do it, making the border a space of inclusion and circulation, while at the same time, other people aren't allowed to do it because the border is now reduced to its exclusionary function. And the thing is, the border is there, it's not disappearing and reappearing, it's just its function where it's changing in a discriminatory way.
Maybe just to draw back the line a little bit, and what I just like very generally got from your explanations now is that in one sense, borders seem very static and very rigid in a sense, and then on the other hand, they are very dynamic at the same time, and they expand to where they maybe not manifest, and it's ever-changing conglomerate of different logics. And here in CRC, we are working with these spatial figures to understand space. And maybe in the first place, maybe we can think about which spatial figures come with borders and how we can conceptualize or think them in the sense of spatial figures. Christina, you've been working the last 4 years on this. Maybe you can elaborate.
Yes, I think it is obvious indeed that borders are related to the territorial space because they are the limits of this of a state territory. They define the territory of a state. So this is maybe the most obvious spatial figure they are related to. But at the same time, I think there are also borders are the places where mobility takes place or where mobility becomes visible, where some mobility is stopped, others is let through. As Paul already said, there are also spaces where mobility is being filtered, like borders filter, in most cases, wanted from unwanted mobility. So this is where I think the trajectorial space also becomes very important, because there's this trajectory of a movement, be it people or goods, that crosses all borders. And at this point, the territorial and the trajectorial space kind of come into conflict at the border, because states use the border to limit their territory and to control mobility. So the border also shows the conflict in a way between movement or mobility and immobility or fixity. And in the same time, they also show this conflict between the different spatial figures, in this case, the territorial space and the trajectorial space. And the border fences that I am researching are a result of these conflicts, I think, because they are the attempt of state power to control their territory and the mobility that crosses their borders.
Yeah. And I mean, we try to use these spatial figures also to identify these different logics of spaces, and the spatial logic of the territorium would be something of containment and homogenization. And then we, at the same time, we have this logic of the trajectorial space, which is more of crossing and permeating, and but in a directed sense, of course. So I think that's very interesting to have these spatial figures in mind if we think about borders, right?
Okay, so regarding the spatial figures that borders come with, I just wanted to underpin the idea of multi-scalarity, because this allows us to overcome the methodological nationalism that it's so often present in our studies. We can talk about borders in urban spaces. Let's think about how airports could be the non-places, but at the same time, places of surveillance that serve to control people on the move. And so in terms of spatial tropes, or figures to depict contemporary borders, I could go with the rhythmatic one because the border is actually the center on a scatter and works as an assemblage of intertwined bordering technologies that are not located in a single place.
So the manifestation of borders is like this not located in one place, but yeah, like basically spreading out like a...
It's like a network of borders.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think this is also one of the very recent and modern developments of how borders are controlled. There are these externalization politics, so the borders moving away from the actual borderline. Border control takes place far away from the borderline. At the same time, there are internal controls, as Paula said. So, for example, an airport, so people already arrived at the territory. Even they already left the airport, they're really on the territory, but still they are being controlled and being treated as if they were not on the territory. So the border is moving to the outside, but also to the inside. And in this way, also this idea of territorial space is, has to be reflected or has to be thought about. What does it mean if the border, the very, very line that normally defines the territorial space, is moving away from it? So this is also an interesting development, also because, as I said, at the same time, the borderline is fortified. So the place of the borderline is very important in some sense. There are fences, more fences than ever in the world. And at the same time, the border and the border control is moving away from this line. So this is also kind of, in the first place, contradictory developments. But it's interesting to think about why this happens at the same time. And what does it mean for spatial figures and for space in general?
Yeah, maybe that's also already like leading to maybe the next question, in the sense that on the one hand, the borders become materialized and manifested, but they don't necessarily produce conflicts within neighboring states. But like conflicts which are more on a different scale, as you just said. And we can speak about these micro-territorial, macro-territorial conflicts which affect border politics. And you already touched upon this, but what would be like primary motivations for enforcing and fortifying borders nowadays?
It is where those intersections I was talking about before of the border with other power regimes such as gender, race, ethnicity, class, nationality materialize. And that's why I think that the fortification of borders are justified by certain political parties, for example. It's where I think that all those symbolic and material processes of the construction of the border are being reified in these critical conjunctures or crises that are being used to justify this kind of enforcement of the border.
I think for the reasons why borders are being fortified today, there have been large quantitative studies that clearly show that the most important reason for fortifying a border is economic inequality between two states. That's very obvious to see, like in most cases, one more powerful and wealthy state builds a fence at his border to another state that is much less wealthy and powerful. But this is, of course, one of many reasons. And I think often there are different reasons that come together. So it's not like this border has been fortified for this reason. There's economic inequality. There's, of course, mobility control. And as you said, sometimes it is a conflict between neighbors, all this very clear inequality between two neighboring states, but often it is about mobility or migratory movements, and those migrants often come from other countries far away. Just for an example, the Hungarian-Serbian border, there's a fence between the two countries, but it was not at all related to a conflict between those two states, and it was not about migrants from Serbia, because Serbians can still travel to Hungary, to the EU, they don't even need a visa. It was about migrants from Syria, from Afghanistan, from other countries far away. And it was also related to different spaces, as for example the European Union, because the Hungarian border is the external EU border. then it was related to Turkey, for example, because the way Turkey acted in this period, 2015, did they open or close their borders, and to what extent they controlled their borders had an enormous influence on what happened at the Hungarian-Serbian border. So there are other spaces and other contexts far away that have an influence on what happens at this border. So in a way, it is to fortify a border is a very nationalist idea in the first place, but in this case, it was kind of the border is globalized in a way because it is related to many different spaces and political dimensions that things that happens elsewhere, as for example, the deal between the Turkey and the EU. I think, yeah, there are very different reasons. I think the most important is mobility control and economic inequality, but there's also terrorism. That is one reason becoming more important. There's smuggling, and often there are different reasons coming together. And as we were already speaking about the symbolic function of borders, there's also internal political reason to fortify borders. Also the Hungarian border fence, as well as Trump's wall, are very good examples to show that there's not always an external logic reason to close a border, but it is about political leaders wanting to be reelected or wanting to have support by their supporters. Yeah, just to finish on this Hungarian example, there was, of course, a big migratory movement at this point, but the people were not migrating to Hungary. They were just crossing by to other European countries, so there were no real reason to fortify this border. If the border would have been open, people would just have crossed Hungary. But Orban used this situation to gain political power. So this is the symbolic reason to close border can be very different from other realities, let's say.
Super interesting that there's like this symbolic power and, like, as you mentioned before, like the visual impact of borders somehow has.
Yeah, and I was thinking while you were talking about the economic inequalities, about how we manage the crisis during the pandemic, and how the countries that could allow themselves to close the borders were the ones that didn't need the money to get in the country, like through tourism or other economic activities. And in the European Union, for example, almost all the countries close the borders and fortify them, justifying this measure because of the pandemic. But at the same time, people from Europe were traveling to Mexico, for example, for touristic reasons. And that's kind of an example of the economic inequalities that are behind the fortification or not of the borders.
Yeah, and in most cases, the borders are not even totally closed or totally opened, but they filter mobility, as I said, in these cases where borders are related to economic inequality. It is often closed in one way. As for example, the border between USA and Mexico, people can cross the border from the US to Mexico. Of course, the border is open in this way, but in the other direction, it is closed. So this economic power means also not just completely closing a border, because that, as Paula said, would be bad also for even for the country building the fence, but to be able to control who can cross the border and who cannot, that is really a question of power.
We are already moving to many concrete examples. Both of you actually study the relationship between two borders, or the same two borders, and we understand that these borders are quite different from each other, even though they touch or like intersect. And it's the border between Spain and Morocco, and Morocco and Algeria, where, you know, there's a whole history, a colonial history of extractivism and migration. So not only the borders intersect, but all these aspects kind of get entangled. And just last year, the border conflict between Morocco and Algeria intensified quite heavily, with the countries even shutting down their economic and diplomatic relations. And Spain, you know, a former quite intense colonizer in this Western Sahara, Northern Africa region, is today one of the countries that still has an external border at the European Union and the Schengen area with the exclave of Ceuta, right?
Yeah.
Exactly. So Maybe to you, Paula, first, what are the current bordering processes and policies of Spain towards Morocco and Western Sahara in general?
Okay, so to cut it short, from a geographical and historical point of view, the troubled relations between Spain, Western Sahara and Morocco have always been shaped by colonialism. The Western Sahara was a Spanish colony until 1975, and that changed after the Green March and the signing of the Declaration of Principles on Western Sahara by Spain, Morocco and Mauritania. The withdrawal of Spain coincided with an offensive campaign led by Morocco that aimed to control the Sahrawi territories and started a long-lasting conflict in the region, with the Moroccan government committing atrocities against Sahrawi people, atrocities that have already been denounced as war crimes and crimes against humanity. As Moroccan forces pushed Sahrawis away, the diaspora, the Polisario Front, and the Sahrawi Arab Democratic Republic are resisting their offensives and repression, not only in the occupied territories, but also in the refugee camps and the free zones. The territorialization of the state in exile. As for Morocco, Spain has had an ambiguous relation with its neighbor country because we can talk about conflict between the two countries, but also about cooperation. The truth is that Morocco has always occupied a central position in the foreign policy agenda of Spanish governments. Particularly, I would like to mention a few elements that are key to understand the current bordering processes and migration policies of Spain towards Morocco and the Western Sahara. First, the role played by Spain in the architecture of the Fortress Europe. As Greece, Italy and Malta, Spain is part of a larger assemblage of overlapping technologies shaping the external border of the European Union and the Schengen area. In this regard, Spain in particular serves to contain and control African-European routes. Migration routes. Think about, for instance, in the so-called refugee crisis of 2015. We can see the flagrant process of externalization of the Spanish border to the Canary Island, Ceuta and Melilla as islands and geographical semi-exclaves, which are quite particular in terms of bordering. But also to third countries or parties that through the signing of different economic and cooperation treaties play a key role controlling migration and becoming a buffer zones. These restrictive policies and bordering practices are bound up to what is being defined as necropolitics, because being on land or at the sea, the Spanish border is a highly deadly one. According to the collective Caminando Fronteras, in 2021, there were more than 4,000 people that died or disappeared when trying to reach or cross the border. So the current situation crisscrossed by the post-COVID context stands out by Sánchez Tarn on Western Sahara, on the Western Sahara question. Actually, in March of this year, when he publicly recognized the sovereignty of Morocco over the Western Sahara. And this was an unprecedented thing to do, because the previous Spanish governments, aware maybe of their abandonment of Western Sahara, have kept a discourse, even if cosmetic, aligned with the United Nations resolutions. As a matter of fact, this whole decision to change the position of Spain with regard to the Western Sahara is cross-cut by the border and territorial disputes over the Canary Islands, Ceuta and Melilla with Morocco. And it is also part of Sánchez's migration agenda, as Morocco is one of those third countries working as a zone of containment or deterrence in the African-European route. It was actually in May, after this geopolitical and diplomatic turn, when the reopening of the border between Morocco and Spain, after more than 2 years officially closed, took place.
Just quickly, Sánchez, he's the current prime minister of Spain.
He's the president.
President.
So, Cristina, you've more closely looked at the Moroccan-Algerian border, right? what's the story there? Is it like complementary to what Paula just said? Because in a sense, probably the European border politics still extend to that border.
Yeah, I'm thinking about how to cut short also a very long and complicated history between those two countries, because the question why this border is being closed today is not that much related to, it is related to migration, but it was not in the first place. And it is not related to economic inequality, as I just said. And in this sense, it is a rather unusual border. But it is related to a very long-standing concurrence and rivalry between those two countries, I think. And it is, of course, related to colonial history, because during the colonial period actually, Morocco supported the Algeria and its fight for independence. So they had a very good relation at first in the first place. But then, as Paula already said, there was this conflict about the Western Sahara, where Morocco claims that the Western Sahara is part of the Moroccan territory, while Algeria supports the independence. And then there is also the fact that during the Cold War, they choose kind of different places in this. In this conflict, Algeria was much more on the eastern side, let's say, and Morocco on the western side. So there's also different political traditions or histories that also enforce this concurrence and rivalry. And then there's also the question of where the border between Morocco and Algeria is situated, because it was finally it was French colonial power that defined this border, and Morocco never accepted the borderline. While Algeria did, so there's also a conflict on this. So both the Western Sahara and this question where the exact borderline is related, of course, to colonial history. Now, today, there are also different topics like migration, as Paula already said. There's a migratory route from sub-Saharan Africa crossing around Algeria and then Morocco, so their common border. There's also the topic of smuggling, because there's a long history of, let's say, small-scale traffic and smuggling across this border. There are also drugs being smuggled from Morocco to Algeria, and gasoline being smuggled the other way around from Algeria to Morocco. So there are many different topics coming together. But I think comparing these two borders, the border between Algeria and Morocco and Morocco and Spain, is very interesting, because it really shows how different borders can work. Because what I said before, the border between Spain and Morocco is very typical in the sense that it is located between two states that are very equal in economic power. At the same time, of course, it is the external border of the European Union. At the same time, it is mostly about migration control. Of course, this border, it has been fortified by Spain against Morocco, let's say. While the border between Algeria and Morocco is not about migration in the first place, these two countries are not that unequal, actually. They are quite equal in economic power and also in political power, let's say. And they actually fortified the border from both sides. They decided in 1994 to close the border, but both countries decided to close it, and both countries fortified it. So that is very unusual. There are not many borders being fortified from both sides, actually. And also, this is not really a filter border, because of the border between Spain and Morocco is also very classic, let's say, in the way that, of course, some people can cross, others cannot. While the border between Morocco and Algeria is more or less completely closed. There's no border crossing on the entire border. It is possible to fly from Morocco to Algeria, but the land border is completely closed. So even for the people living close to the border, they cannot cross it, which is quite tragic for them. But yeah, as I said, in a way, it's a very unusual border, which makes it very interesting to compare these two borders and their function.
To jump maybe a little bit to a different function yet again, you've looked especially on the digital discursive construction of the far right in Spain and how this intersects with like the border fortification between Spain and Morocco, right?
Yeah, more than fortification, I would say reification. But yes, I drew attention to this topic when I was working with an NGO called AYETI, mapping hate speeches and hate crimes against women, LGBTQIA plus people, racialized people and migrants in Spain. And in this particular work, we analyzed the circulation of phobic rhetoric produced by far-right parties in Twitter. By doing so, I realized that there was a discursive reinforcement of the border, and it ended up being a central part in the nativist and nationalist political agendas of this kind of political formations. Robert Sack said that territoriality can be easy to communicate because it requires only one kind of marker or sign, that is the boundary. And drawing from that idea, I wonder about the communicative production of a space, the productivity of the discursive production of the border, and how this serves as a mechanism of actual verification, and how metadata and digital public spaces were being used specifically to that end. For example, during the immigration crisis in the Canary Island and Ceuta, and paralleling the COVID-19 pandemic in Twitter, following the personal accounts of representatives of the far-right party Vox, and also its respective communities of followers that, I don't know if you know, but go beyond the country, and we saw that have links with other far-right parties in Europe and Latin America as well. So they were using this hashtag, Fronteras Seguras, that can be translated as safe borders. And they were constantly generating this message of the border, not only reinforcing the border as such, but also just justifying the need of restrictive measures to put the brakes to what they call the invasion of Spain.
So we've looked quite a bit into the past and current situation, and there was this narrative of decreasing borders in the past within border studies, but it has become clear that currently borders have become even more fortified and have all these different layers of how they're working and integrating different politics and policies and movements and logics. And maybe to try a look into the future and to grasp in front of all these crises we have at the moment, and one of the big ones also being climate change, what might this imply for future border politics? Or maybe what would you maybe also wish for future border and migration policies?
It is an issue already. It is hard to see it because it is very hard to define what is climate migration. I mean, climate change or environmental change has an impact on how people live, on their economic situation, and then on their decision to migrate. But it's very different, difficult to say like who is really a climate migrant or who is more, who migrated for different reasons. But then also I think climate change will cause many conflicts in the future, and it is already causing conflicts because there are conflicts about resources, and then this is making already existing conflicts more dangerous. And even, for example, the Syrian war is said to be linked to climate change because people were in economic difficult situations, they were hungry and so on, and this was also caused this conflict. So just to say, the future we are looking at is also will be shaped by climate change-induced migration, by climate change-induced conflicts, and this is where borders become very important, of course, because, as I said, borders are the places where movement is being controlled. And I think the fact that borders already being more fortified than before today becomes a bit scary if we look at climate change, because if the borders are already fortified, it is much easier for states just to close them up and to not care about people being on the move because of climate change. And it's still a very open question what will happen if there are this big migratory movements that we surely will see because of climate change. I mean, most of this migration is internal migration, so it's quite easy to for northern countries to just close their borders and to leave the climate migrants or those migratory movements in their own regions and their own countries. But as you ask also for what we wish for, the much more positive development would, of course, be that the global north would take its responsibility for climate change and also take this as a reason for changing border politics and migration politics instead of just using this already existing border control systems, rather to think about what would be an equal or a right way to treat these issues that are global issues, of course, and in the first place caused by the global north, but in the first place causing problem in the global south, actually. So yeah, that would be my wish, that the future development is not to further fortify borders, but rather to think about how to deal with this topic in a more human way, let's say.
Thank you, Christina, Paula.
Thank you for your patience.